On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin, Mr. Brian Chee here today. And we talk about municipal broadband once again, but this time we talk about a new bill that's going through Ohio that might ban municipal broadband altogether. We'll definitely get into that. Plus, have you ever thought about the multi-cloud and building, deploying applications in it, but maybe also adding a little bit of machine learning models and algorithms into the mix? It's not easy. It's complex. They definitely get stuck in a walled garden. Well, today we have Chief Data Scientist Josh Paduska from Domino Labs. He's going to take us through the journey of knocking down some walls and also using containers to do it. You shouldn't miss it. Twiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 448, recorded June 18th, 2021. Data models are us. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by PlexTrack, the powerful yet simple security management platform that helps you get the real cybersecurity work done. With PlexTrack, you'll streamline your assessments, analytics, and reporting. Visit PlexTrack.com/twit and claim your free month. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I really can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field. Song with their own enterprise security expert. He's a senior analyst at Omdia. And he's our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how's the week treating you, my friend?
Week is treating me pretty well. Getting ready for some webinars that are coming up, as well as presentations and Black Hat. So lots of interesting stuff happening, studying up and preparing presentations on things like turning employees into allies, figuring out how to go from awareness to actual action on the part of your employees, the kind of things that tend to get lost in the technology shuffle, but are critical for enterprise security.
Indeed they are. Indeed they are. So, well, speaking of taking action, we have our network and security expert and all-around tech geek, Mr. Brian Chee. Chiebert, what have you been up to this week in your new digs?
It's all about fixing stuff and trying to figure out how to run cables. You know, sadly, if you have a house where it's not a full-size attic, it's just a crawl space, if you are a little heavy, kind of like me, wandering up there is a challenge. So you want to make sure you're placing your feet in the right place, and you want to try and avoid crawl spaces whenever you can. So I went and discovered that Amazon has Bluetooth endoscopes now really cheap. And so I'm going to be able to go and run the endoscope up into the attic and see if I can go run some Cat 6 cables around and avoid going up into a really hot, uncomfortable crawl space.
Well, I'll tell you, as I age, any space is uncomfortable. So I totally get that for sure. Well, speaking of age, we don't have an aging set of news this week. We have some new news and some really exciting stuff. So let's get to that. Thank you, Chiebert and Curtis, for being here for sure. We, we've talked about municipal broadband in the past and just how it helps rural areas especially gain better and faster internet than they have, or maybe not even have internet at all. But it looks like a new bill might actually place a near total ban on municipal broadband in Ohio, stopping it in its tracks. So we'll definitely get into that and what that means. Now, have you thought about maybe multi-cloud approaches and building and deploying applications? How about maybe intermixing a little bit of machine learning models and algorithms into that? Well, it's not easy. You get stuck in a walled garden. That's right. Well, we have today Chief Data Scientist Josh Paduska, and he's going to, he's from Domino Labs, and he's going to actually go take us through a journey on just how to knock some walls down and maybe even use containers to do it. Shouldn't miss that. But first, like we always do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. The cyber criminals and attack groups continue to target manufacturers, with one in five companies in the sector compromised in a successful attack, according to a survey published by security firm Morphosec this week. Now, the Manufacturing Cybersecurity Threat Index report consists of a survey response from 567 manufacturing employees and found that nearly a quarter of firms are actually attacked weekly, and more than a third are attacked every month. Now, the numbers are likely conservative, as not all manufacturing employees are aware when a company is actually attacked. Now, the report is the latest showing that manufacturing sector faces a heightened threat landscape. Now, a March report found that ransomware payments have nearly tripled, with manufacturing among the most targeted industries, which also includes healthcare, information technology, and construction. Now, a survey of 250 IT and 250 operational technology workers found that 61% of companies experienced a cybersecurity incident affecting their factories, and three quarters of those incidents took production offline, according to another March report. Now, currently, the ransomware accounts for only 13% of the attempted attacks on endpoints, but InfoStealers account for 31% and Fileless attacks around 28%. And what this means for ransomware groups is there is an increased focus on them. That's right. This means ransomware groups have to evolve due to increased pressure brought by law enforcement and private companies against the operators. Now, rather than larger groups focus on massive campaigns, Morphosec has witnessed the rise of smaller groups. Now, the fact that manufacturing industry has somewhat gone remote over the past year has only aided these cyber criminals. Now, while 76% of manufacturing employees said that they've had at least some colleagues working from home during COVID-19, nearly two-thirds said they think this has increased the risk of breach against their organization. Definitely has. Now, vulnerabilities that affect the virtual private network software used by many of these companies have also been reported in the past year and have affected many, many manufacturers. Now, vulnerabilities that affect the virtual private network software used by them could actually, you know, aid to how cyber criminals and actually help them attack. You know, education helps start the battle, but you know what? Knowing is only half the battle. So hopefully sooner or later, they'll get educated and move forward.
Meanwhile, in Geneva, President Joe Biden said in a press conference that he and President Vladimir Putin of Russia agreed to bring together cybersecurity experts from the two nations to establish, quote, specific understandings about what's off limits, end quote, from cyber activity, and how the U.S. and Russia each would follow up on cyber attacks that originate in either of our countries. He said he provided Putin with a list of some 16 critical infrastructure sectors, including energy and water, which should be off limits to hacking. Biden does not provide additional details, but noted that the U.S. has significant cyber capability that it will use if Russia violates these basic norms. Quote, responsible countries need to take action against criminals who conduct ransomware activities on their territory, end quote, he explained to the Russian president.
Well, Google seems to be interested in making things more secure, and to that end, have enabled end-to-end encryption for Android's latest default SMS/RCS app. Google has announced that end-to-end encryption is rolling out to users of Google Messages, Android's default SMS and RCS app. The feature has been in testing for months, and now it's coming to everyone. Now, encryption in Google Messages works only if both users are on the service. Both users must also be in a one-to-one chat. Sorry, no group chats allowed. And they both must have RCS turned on. RCS was supposed to be a replacement for SMS and on by default and become the carrier-driven text messaging standard. Well, RCS was cooked up in 2008, and it adds 2008-level features to carrier messaging like user presence, typing status, read receipts, and location sharing. Well, text messaging used to be a cash cow for carriers, but with the advent of unlimited texting and the commoditization of carrier messaging, there's no clear revenue motivation for carriers to release RCS. The result is the RCS rollout has amounted to nothing but false promises and delays. The carriers actually nixed a joint venture called the Cross-Carrier Messaging Initiative, and last April pretty much killed any hopes that RCS will ever hit SMS-like ubiquity. Apple executives have also indicated internally that they view easy messaging with Android as a threat to the iOS ecosystem lock-in, so it would take a significant change of heart for Apple to support RCS. Well, we talked about this earlier, about how cross-carrier messaging initiative never went anywhere. But with Google fixing its cloud, we may finally get end-to-end encryption supported natively, certainly on Android. But here's hoping that iOS isn't far behind.
The Ukrainian police have arrested members of a notorious ransomware gang that recently targeted American universities as pressure mounts on global law enforcement to crack down on cyber criminals. Now, the Ukrainian National Police said in a statement this week that it worked with Interpol and the U.S. and South Korean authorities to charge six members of the Ukrainian-based Klop hacker group, which it claimed had inflicted $500 million in damages on victims based in the U.S. and South Korea. Now, the move marks the first time that a national law enforcement agency has carried out massive arrests of a ransomware gang, adding to pressure on other countries to follow suit. Now, Russia, hub for ransomware gangs, have been blamed for harboring cyber criminals by failing to prosecute or extradite them. Now, Klop is one of the several ransomware cartels that seize the target's data, demanding a ransom to release it. The group has also increasingly threatened to leak sensitive information online if a target refused to pay, a tactic known as double extortion. Now, recent targets have included oil company Shell, international law firm Jones Day, as well as several U.S. universities, including Stanford and the University of California. Now, in most cases, the hackers wielded a vulnerability in a file transfer product run by Acelion to compromise their victim. Now, as part of this Klop takedown, the Ukrainian police said that it had conducted 21 searches in the Kiev region of homes and cars of those arrested, seizing computer equipment and around $185,000 and property. A video footage shared by the police showed officers raiding homes in what appeared to be wealthy neighborhoods and towing luxury cars, including Teslas. And it just goes down to show you, ransomware groups will continue to evolve over time, but if law enforcement evolved with them, it'll make it less profitable to try and get away with such an attack.
Well, tech's growth is leaving black professionals further and further behind. The tech industry has talked for years about increasing diversity in its ranks with little to no progress to show so far, given all the talk. One reason for that is a lack of concrete, sustained action to find and retain black candidates, as well as Latino and women job seekers. But there are deeper issues at play, according to a new conference board report. Structural issues limit the participation of black candidates, even for those companies that seriously seek to hire and retain them, and as the U.S. tech industry grows and struggles to fill its ranks. Adding to the problem is that those hired in tech get paid less than their white counterparts, which is also an issue for the Latino workers and the women workers. The conference board's analysis of U.S. employment data shows that only 4% of top earners in the tech industry are black, compared to 6% in other industries. And among software developers who have seen the highest income growth of all, black representation stands at just 3.3%. Now, the racial wage gap is not limited to the tech industry. Black workers are similarly underrepresented in other booming fields for top earners, accounting for just 2.8% of top-earning CEOs and 3.8% of top earners in marketing management. The report makes a number of common-sense suggestions for companies to take to address the problem, and the conference board also says more needs to be done at a systemic level, particularly in education and societal inclusion beginning at birth, to reduce barriers that exclude African Americans from the tech industry in the first place.
Well, this article comes to us from Ars Technica. And while the FTC doesn't sound like it's going to affect us, it does. Anyway, let's go on. It's a long article, so I'm going to encourage you to read it in its entirety. But Lisa Kahn, who has been a big tech skeptic, was named the FTC chair by the Biden administration mere hours after the confirmation. President Joe Biden named Lisa Kahn chair of the FTC just hours, and it's an unusual move. Nearly nominated newly nominated commissioners are seldom elevated to the chair immediately, and it's likely signals that the Biden administration will be taking a hawkish approach to antitrust enforcement, particularly when it comes to big tech platform companies like Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple. Well, jumping forward in the article, some history about Ms. Khan. As a law student several years ago, Khan published a highly influential paper that recast the debate over anti-competitive behavior, particularly among big tech firms. In the paper titled Amazon's Antitrust Paradox, Khan argued that using prices as the primary gauge of anti-competitive behavior was an insufficient measure of marketing power among certain firms, particularly big tech companies and their platforms. The risks are twofold, she said. First, the economics of platform markets create incentives for a company to pursue growth over profits, a strategy that investors have rewarded over the years. Under these conditions, predatory pricing becomes highly rational, even as an existing doctrine treats it as irrational and therefore implausible, according to Ms. Khan. Second, because online platforms serve as critical intermediaries, integrating across business lines positions these platforms to control the essential infrastructure on which their rivals depend. These two qualities of today's platforms has also allowed big tech companies to collect data on rivals, putting the rivals in uncompetitive positions. Well, my opinion is this new FTC chair isn't going to use the same yardstick as her predecessors, which I, for one, think is a good thing. And while her position papers are making tech giants nervous, the end result could very well have the Biden administration letting some of these giants grow rather than calling for a breakup.
A bipartisan group of senators this week unveiled legislation intended to crack down on cyber criminals who have increasingly posed a threat to critical U.S. organizations. Now, introduced was the International Cybercrime Prevention Act, which would enhance criminal violations for hackers targeting critical infrastructure such as dams, power plants, hospitals, and election equipment. It would also expand the Justice Department's ability to go after botnet groups by allowing the injunctions against botnets involved in certain destructive cyber attacks, destruction of data, or other issues that pose a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The bill would also ban the sale of access to a compromised computer if the buyer intends to use this access to create damage, and it cracks down on the sales of certain surveillance and spyware devices as well. Now, what does this mean for cyber criminals? Well, it means that the cost of doing business just got a bit more rich. Now, this legislation will hopefully give law enforcement more tools to shut down botnets and ensure higher stakes for attacks. The bill was introduced after a year in which cyber attacks have spiked worldwide against a number of critical groups, including healthcare organizations and other hospitals amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, schools, local governments, and other critical organizations have also been targeted here. Adding to the tools in the tool chest against the fight of cyber criminals will continue to assist in the effort. However, unless more of these groups are caught and prosecuted, it won't mean much to remove one weed from a garden of weeds. We'll see just how sharp the tools get very, very soon. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Let's go ahead and jump in this week's bites. Now, we've talked about municipal broadband in the past and all of its advantages that come along with it. Well, a new bill might actually ban municipal broadband in Ohio. Very interesting. What's going on here, Cheaper?
Well, what's got everybody with their knickers in a twist, shall we say, is that the bill is saying that a 10 megabit per second link is considered good enough. And we all know that 10 meg means with overhead and all that other stuff, that's barely enough for a Zoom link to stay stable. Well, anyway, Ohio's legislature, in this case, the Senate specifically, is saying, no, we know better. That's perfectly good. I could actually hear people like Mo, our co-host Heather Williams, actually starting to throw things around when she listens to this, because she's a firm believer that that's not true. And we have some friends that work for the Ohio courts that would probably start throwing things too. Anyway, this article from Ars Technica talks about the Ohio Senate on June 9th approving a budget bill that contains an anti-municipal broadband amendment. Now, thankfully, it's not a done deal yet, and advocates for public networks are urging the legislature to strip the amendment from the final budget. So this is basically someone put a rider on something that's critical. But anyway, if passed, the proposed law could kill existing broadband services and prevent new ones from being deployed. There are reportedly 30 or more municipal broadband providers in Ohio that would not be allowed to operate so long as there is a private sector company operating in the area, as there are in most cities. So basically, even if it's a really, really old, you know, first generation DSL, as long as it can provide at least 10 meg per second, they can push out community broadband. Now, we've had several community broadband people on the show over the years, and almost in every single case, the service quality skyrocketed. And in many cases, it also encouraged the incumbent ISPs to clean up their act. And that's what I keep hearing. When I was at the Wireless Internet Service Provider Conference before the pandemic, lots of people were saying that what it really took was just about anyone going in, community or otherwise, and actually give these big ISPs competition. And so let's see what happens. Now, interestingly enough, what has been made clear is that Cleveland, one of the larger cities in Ohio, has also said flat out, if it's enacted, we're going to sue. Now, lots and lots of stuff. It's a long article. Again, strongly, strongly encourage you to read the article in its entirety. And I will tell you, there's going to be an awful lot of states watching this very, very carefully. I, for one, have actually been contemplating thinking, gee, community broadband in my new neighborhood would actually be a pretty good thing. So now, community broadband brings a lot of baggage. And from a legislative or a commercial point of view, doesn't really matter in this case, it's competition. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to go fishing with Kurt first and say, hey, you've been talking to a lot of other analysts and you've been talking to the folks in the C-suite. Have you heard any kind of words of pro or con on community broadband from those arenas?
Well, let's look first at who would be impacted by community broadband. And by and large, this is not going to be something that has an impact on companies. Companies or organizations that, by and large, have the money to pull their own cable, arrange for their own broadband service. Now, what does end up being impacted are their customers, especially their customers who may be in lower income and underserved areas. Now, those areas, those customers can get the companies involved because the companies find that it is in their best interest to have customers with better broadband. When it comes to that broadband, the companies really don't care where it comes from, and they're completely happy to have it come from a municipality or a county government or some other unit of government. I think the place that this is really hitting home are those places, as Brian said, that are not unserved, but are marginally served. There are companies out there that tend to be smaller companies, although they can be branches of larger companies that provide really borderline broadband service. They're the ones who especially don't want any competition from government because they know that the step from bad broadband to good broadband can be bigger and more expensive than the step from no broadband to bad broadband. And I think what we're going to have is this fight between the municipalities that want to provide their citizens with genuine broadband and those companies who want to provide them with something less for the same money as real broadband.
Oh, this is actually a case when I absolutely love our chat room. Scooter X mentioned that municipal broadband is restricted in 18 states across the U.S. as of 2021. And that's an article from broadbandnow.com /municipal-broadband-roadblocks. Now, broadband is one of those things that needs a definition. And sadly, the previous administration set very, very low standards. And this is one of the reasons why I'm actually more than a little excited about the FTC chairman coming in, because she's sharpening her pencil. And I think she's going to set higher limits. Now, she's not exactly super tech friendly, but I think more than likely she's going to be holding some people's feet to the fire. Now, one of our founding member, you know, Robert Padre Balliser, had some really, really interesting comments back when we had one of the broadband folks talk about doing fiber optic in certain areas of San Francisco. And his comments were really and truly about how the competition made a massive, massive difference in the incumbents getting their act together. This is going to be interesting, especially as the Biden administration opens the purse strings to get a lot of broadband, which is technically community broadband, into native reservations where they have been typically underserved. So, Mr. Liu, you were in the Seattle area, and there was some community broadband, or at least some noise about it. I wish we had Mo here, because there's definitely a lot of community broadband in Texas. But what have you heard? You're now in the east, up northeast, and you got lucky with having Fios. But what else have you been starting to hear? You know, is your new area pro or against community broadband?
Yeah, that's a good question. In the Seattle area, they, they had a lot of community broadband. In fact, the Issaquah Highlands was one of the ones that was closest to me. Issaquah Highlands is a little town of Issaquah, has a community called the Highlands, and all of the homes there have its own broadband. They had set it up. They basically trunked it off the CenturyLink fiber lines and have it available to all the homes there. And it's a fantastic. It's $30 a month. It's in your HOA. Like, it's available for all communities, all, you know, especially when people were working from home. It was amazing. And network, it doesn't cost that much for them to run. And again, even area that I used to live, they were trying to get that set up and as well. Now, the, you know, this interesting about this article is the fact that they believe that 10 megabit per second is being served as broadband. And I don't know about you, if you ever looked at the stats of your Skype calls or Zoom calls or your, or even just your, you know, remote desktop session, that's not going to cut it. No matter what you can say, you know, whether how much you compress your data, you're never going to be able to use 10 megabit, even if it's up or down, to be able to do all of that. So this is just a very interesting, I'm hoping that there'll be some, some additional corporations and companies like KeyBank and other large organizations, Prudential, in the Ohio area that push back on this. But in the same sense, where I live, there actually is a very small amount of monopoly here, actually. We have Fios, we have Cox, we have a couple other smaller broadband or companies. So we don't have this problem of having to deal with or have even set up municipal broadband. But in the same sense, I'm hoping that some of these law restrictions around it go away. So we'll see hopefully in the near future.
Actually, one of the things that I was actually looking for, and I can't find it right now. I literally just got spammed on my Facebook feed for a company that says, hey, if you're an HOA or an apartment or something like that, talk to us because we want to do community broadband just for you. That is an interesting and really telling set of spam. And realistically, more and more neighborhoods are going for what's called undergrounding, where the power carriers are saying, we'd rather be underground than on poles. And one of the big questions that come up is, what's going to happen to the poles? You know, what if there are other people on it? And I'm just wondering out loud. I don't know for a fact, but gee, wouldn't it be cool if the community took possession of those poles and ran their own? Makes you want to go, Anyway, this is an interesting story, and it's going to keep going. And especially when there's both pro and con on the Terragraph wireless protocol, but at 60 gigahertz, which is unlicensed, by the way, I work with Siklu, but there's others coming out. 60 gigahertz in a 360 degree sector panel, if I can get a gig feed or better from a MPLS metro ring and feed that in through, say, a firewall, and then we can go and provide, you know, 60 plus homes. So one feed, and I could feed the entire subdivision that I'm in. Kind of interesting. Now, some of the folks in the chat room are talking about, they do Wi-Fi in townhouses and it's terrible. Yeah, I agree, because a lot of the people that are doing HOA-based shared internet don't know what they're doing. They're trying to do it with 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz, and they're trying to do it as cheaply as possible. My suggestion really is there's an awful lot of other ways of doing it. There's some really nice fiber where you literally glue it up into where the wall and the ceiling meet, and it gets hidden, and you can paint it. 60 gigahertz is a great way to get in between buildings. And then run copper or fiber within places. There's a lot of wireless internet service providers that would like to do this and would love to be able to start up. But when you have legislation like this putting in yet more barriers, maybe not. I don't know. Anyway, I'm ranting. This is definitely a Chiebert soapbox. I firmly believe in community broadband, and I think the internet service providers need the competition. Here's hoping that people call their Congress critters and local legislators and express your opinion, because in the end, you voted them into office. Now you need to go and start really and truly getting off your behind, making your opinion known, because your vote does count. Anyway, Lou, hey, we've chewed up a lot of time. Don't you think maybe we need to go and move on to our guest?
I think so. That comes about time. My favorite part of the show, we actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Rye. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's PlexTrack. Now, they are the security management platform that brings you better reports, deeper assessments, and more insights. Let me ask you a question. Do you spend hours and hours reporting security issues and feel like it's getting you nowhere? I bet you also bury it in data but still can't get a full picture of your security posture to prioritize remediation efforts. We got the solution for you. That's right. PlexTrack empowers continuous assessment, automated workflow, and effective collaboration between teams to help cybersecurity professionals do more in less time. Now, create assessment reports in half the time and centralize your remediation efforts across all scans, assessments, and audits through a powerful risk visualizations, scanners, and ticketing integrations, and enhanced analytics to effectively communicate risks in real time. Now, whether it's red or blue, there is a PlexTrack for every security professional to save time and get the right work done. Now, red teams can import findings from numerous vulnerability scanners. They can also include screenshots and videos with auto formatting, plus create customized templates and export to Word with just one click. They can also streamline the report writing process to deliver better reports faster. Now, the blue team can actually customize internal and external assessment questionnaires. They can also synchronize findings with task management tools like Jira Cloud, plus assign findings to team members and track status over time. And they can also provide attestation of security posture with robust analytics. Now, on April 12th, Plextrack announced that they've closed a $10 million round to fuel growth of their cybersecurity workflow platform. Venture firms Nora Mosley, partners in Madrona Venture Group, led the round with participation from Stage.io Ventures. Plextrack will use the funds to continue building the team and growing the platform. Now, Plextrack improves the entire security engagement lifecycle by making it easy to generate security reports, deliver them securely, and track the issues to completion straight from the platform. Book a demo today. Try Plextrack for free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to plextrack.com/twit and claim your free month. That's plextrac.com/twit. And we thank Plextrack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have Chief Data Scientist Josh Paduska from Domino Labs. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks, Lou. It's great to be here.
Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us on a short journey through tech and what brought you to Domino Labs?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I've always known I'd do something in math, something related to analytics in my career. And I remember when I got my undergrad in math, I was getting my undergrad. I was lucky enough to find my sweetheart at the time, and we were married while going through school together. And she bought me a book, Great Jobs for Math Majors. And it was a creative book where you could tell they were stretching, trying to find what could a math major do that would be a great job besides teach. And luckily for me, as I got into my career, my first job was as a database analyst and doing just some light business intelligence. I recalled back to all of those statistics classes that I took during my undergrad. And I said, man, if I was just a little bit better at statistics, if I knew how to turn this data into insights, I could really rock at this job as a analyst, database analyst, and business intelligence person. So I decided to go back and to school and get my master's degree. Got my master's from Cornell applied statistics. And during that time, I decided to focus. This was back in the early 2000s. I decided to focus on what they called at that time data mining. This is before data science was even a term. And lucky for me, that became a pretty hot market to be in. And I just found it fascinating. Just fascinating that you could try to take mountains of data that was unstructured, unorganized, and cull intelligence out of it. And then that intelligence could be game-changing for businesses, game-changing for people. Now we're seeing that in everyday lives. We're all affected by data science predictive models. So that's how I got into the space. And just noticing that you know, we could really do great things with this data if we knew how to handle it. And since then, I've been in the industry about 20 years, worked for a variety of companies, about half my time hands-on, half my time in leadership roles, looking at vision and helping at a higher level. And it's been a great ride so far, and I'm real happy to be here today to talk about some of the latest trends that we're seeing in data science and AI and machine learning. There's, as your audience knows, a lot happening in the space right now.
Now, that's good. It's a good segue into the topic, because I know I build a lot of applications, enterprise services, and I work with a lot of organizations that do so as well. And they tend to end up, you know, building it on, let's say, a one cloud specific platform, let's say, mm-hmm. you know, AWS or whatnot. And they get all their data stored in some cloud storage there. And then they tend to tack on machine learning models against that data. So that's the kind of their starter way of getting into developing models and developing analytics on their data. But what ends up happening is they end up get kind of stuck. They get stuck because they're using the predefined models that are available to them, and then the platform to develop those models. And so moving them somewhere else becomes very, you know, not very cost effective. Now, what are you seeing from an organization perspective? What are organizations doing when they get into that bind?
Yeah, the problem that you're defining speaks to the end result of that problem is you cannot get data products into production. That's really where this leads to. In 2018, Gartner reported that upwards of 85% of data science projects were not getting into production. We're a little bit better in 2021 now, but we're still at 75% are not getting into production. And the reason is usually that there's a disconnect between the business, what the business needs, what the end consumers need, and what the developers and the data scientists are building. And that disconnect can only be solved by hands-on data science. We're not yet at the point where you can take an easy button, push that easy button, use, as you said, pre-built, pre-canned models, and have those go all the way into production and add significant value. There's just going to be too many barriers along the way, too many decisions along the way that humans have to make. So maybe 20 years from now, we'll get better at automating this whole AI production lifecycle, but we're not there yet. We're not anywhere close. So you need data scientists that are trained in that profession to be able to do the code, talk to the business experts. You need translators that can mediate between the two, data engineers that can help you get the data. It takes a team. It takes a team of researchers and analysts to make these data products. And these data products are incredibly valuable. You probably all heard of Netflix recommendation engine that's valued over $1 billion. That's one algorithm valued over $1 billion to Netflix. And I could list story and story and story of other companies that are just betting their business on machine learning, AI, data science. So it's a high-stakes game. People are jumping into it with both feet. Those that aren't jumping in are going to find themselves left behind. But you can't rely on that easy button from one vendor. You have to enable open, flexible data science, and you have to build your own teams internally or outsource those teams.
Right, and that kind of brings us into my next question, and we're very related to Domino Labs, is what is Domino Labs doing here to help? I know that there's a lot of organizations that are using you to help bridge that divide. How are they using you, and what are you guys offering?
Yeah, I've been with Domino about 3 years now, and the reason I made the jump over to Domino is because the software platform that Domino built and is continuing to improve and build just resonated with me with where I think the industry needs to go. And data science needs to go from this back office back office kind of technical practice into an enterprise organizational capability. So Domino creates a data science platform, an enterprise MLOps platform. We're focused on enabling teams of data scientists to scale across the enterprise. So we're not a 1-2 person team. Our platform is not geared for that. It's geared for more of your mid-market and larger companies that are really serious about scaling data science and getting, let's call it model velocity, getting that model velocity, that scale of getting models into production in their enterprise. So, more than 20% of the Fortune 100 uses Domino, global banks, health insurers, ratings agencies, pharma companies, especially where you have a strong regulatory and compliance need, where you need to keep track of the system of record of all the data science work that's going on. That's where Domino's platform really shines. And it does so, I think it's important for me to point out, in an open manner. So Python, R, SAS, SAS, MATLAB, and all the different tools that go along with those languages are all under one platform, and you can jump between them in projects and just allow collaboration and get rid of all the headaches that data scientists don't like to deal with, so they can focus on building good data products and bringing that number of projects not in production, bringing that way down, adding value to the company.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that being able to kind of share Work on different platforms, but still be able to collaborate. And I see this a lot. I work with organizations like, let's say, in the financial sector, that you have different groups that are kind of targeting different parts of, different parts of organization, whether it's their general ledger or their inventory or something like that. And they're trying to figure out, and sometimes they're developing models and parts of models that are not necessarily reused. Like they basically rebuild these things from the ground up every time. So you have different teams of data scientists are rebuilding these models. And so they develop these models and develop the analytics from these models. And they share the data and say, hey, I did this. And they say, oh, we already built that piece. And then we've added onto it to produce more insights. So you get that problem where you're not necessarily reusing code or you're reusing these things. How is Domino going to help that?
So this is part of, going back 3 years when I joined Domino and the vision they had. I've been around data science long enough to know how it usually works. It usually works with kind of desktop IT. Data scientists have their favorite packages, their favorite language. They'll put it onto their laptop, and you get this laptop sprawl across the organization. And you can't collaborate. You can't collaborate very well within your team, and forget about trying to collaborate across teams and share ideas and share context. So with a centralized platform that takes care of provisioning compute, takes care of managing Docker environments, which is where you define what your software environment should look like for a particular set of projects. Once you take care of that and you start to track metadata and you organize your projects in the way that data scientists like to work, now you've got people in HR looking at data scientists in HR looking at what data scientists in supply chain are doing, looking at what data scientists in working with customer data are doing. And if they're all doing forecast models, they can compare notes, compare code, search each other's code, and learn from each other. And you can start to very quickly build your organizational knowledge, and you can reuse components, either code snippets or entire projects or modeling approaches or data sets, curated data, what have you. All these different assets and components of a data science lifecycle can now be tracked, versioned, tagged, searched, shared, and it really starts to create an acceleration factor in an agency, in an organization, in an enterprise. And that's really where I see the winners and the losers in enterprise AI, that dividing line is going to be, is with those that can scale. Those that can scale their process are going to come out on top. Those that can't scale their process are going to continue to be around the 70-75% fail rate. There are too many barriers at play to overcome on your own. You have to get a hive mindset going in order to really get what you want to get.
Yeah, I love this. I love this to have that high transparency and to be able to share visibility into the work that you're doing. And these things help even just normal software development organizations, but let alone helping data scientists and groups kind of mm-hmm. scale their efforts. So I love this. I do want to get into more, but I do want to also bring my co-host back in because they're also chomping at the bit here behind the scenes. So I'll throw to Kurt first. Kurt?
Thanks, Lou. And my question revolves around the building these models, creating these data sets, and as you talked about, the hive mind. Have you found that there's any value in having a hive mind that's made up of more diverse, independent minds? We've seen a number of cases in the security world where companies came very close to doing model poisoning on themselves because they managed to build biases into the models that they were using as they were training their machine learning or their AI. Is that something that you have noticed that you help warn organizations against, or is there anything companies can do in the context of data science to guard against that sort of issue?
Yeah, I've been very interested and have followed closely the bias and ethics conversation in data science, both from a legal and high level, but also from a technical level. What are the new techniques and procedures coming out of academia and industry to answer the problem of how do we explain this black box model? And can we, as we're learning how to explain it, can we spot bias and ethical issues inside of that model? As you can imagine, having a strong system of record for data science in the enterprise and having a good knowledge management database across teams of data scientists is definitely going to help solve that problem in the way that as soon as one person figures out how to check for bias in a particular type of modeling approach, they can very easily share that with other teams and other data scientists using a platform like Domino. The other thing that is very important with all that is model monitoring. Like I said, I've been in this industry for a long time. 15 years ago, we were talking about model monitoring and how important it was. And only in the last, I'll say, 3 years are you seeing vendors, software vendors, get real serious about model monitoring and building it into their platforms. So with Domino being an enterprise MLOps platform, we were one of the first to release model monitoring capabilities. And it's a big focus of ours, and we're going to continue to invest in that. But having a strong monitoring system is just absolutely critical. You should not be in the business of putting AI, ML into production without first considering how is this going to be monitored? How is it going to be maintained? How am I going to check for bias? How am I going to check for drift in incoming data and make sure that I get ahead of changes to that data where I might start making decisions that I never intended to make with these models that are just live and crunching out decisions in real time.
Okay, now I want to ask one somewhat technical question. You're talking about model monitoring. In the world of AI, there are two forms of training a model. There's supervised learning and unsupervised learning, basically one where you go and very deliberately shove information into the model to get it started, the other where the system builds its own information. Is your model monitoring predicated on one of those or the other, or does it really work with either supervised or unsupervised model building?
It's going to work with both. So the foundations, if we're looking at this from a technical perspective, the foundations of model monitoring are, first of all, does the model meet standard service level agreements? Is it giving you what you need in the amount of time and in the way that you want it? That's very basic. And most everybody kind of has that already. Taking it a step further, you need to also look at incoming data. So the data coming into the model, when you trained it, either in an unsupervised way or a supervised way, there was a world of data that it learned upon. And that data is going to change over time. COVID-19 showed us that. So many models, especially related to customer behavior, just went screwy with the change in the economics of our world after COVID hit. And those models need to be retrained and rebuilt or just paused until we can get a handle, until the world calms down and we know how it's going to behave. I know several companies that bet their business on predictive models for customer data just push pause. They said, all right, we just got to wait until all this calms down. And those are both supervised and unsupervised models. And the third thing you need to do is look at the predictions those models are giving out. So you have service level agreements, basic stuff, checking for shifts in the underlying distributions of data coming in, and then also checking for shifts in the predictions that are coming out. Those are the three main things that you do from a technical perspective. Along with that, you're also going to want a system for retraining models automatically. You're going to want a strong system for validating models. You want an audit trail. You want to keep track of the experimentation that went into the model so that when it does come time to retrain them, you can fully reproduce that work very easily, and a platform can help you do that in a streamlined manner so that you're not searching through files and files and files, if you will, to try to figure out what were we thinking when we built this model. That needs to all be captured for you and saved in the knowledge management system.
Well, my turn. I'm an ex-academic. I just retired from the University of Hawaii School of Ocean Earth Science and Technology. And data models are us. But one of the lessons that I learned over the years of lots and lots of statistics background is you can literally make statistics say anything you want if you know how to tweak the numbers. And model monitoring is basically a scientist's bread and butter. Did you make the right assumptions? And one of the things I'm going to go off a little bit is, gee, you're applying this to business. But gee, some of those tools sound like they'd be amazing for physical oceanographers and people in academia. Are you eventually going to slide in that direction? Is there even enough money to justify your involvement?
You know, for everything I said about model monitoring, and I am passionate about it, I feel like we're at the very precipice of our ability as an industry to properly monitor models. I think, it's my opinion, that probably from academia, but maybe from industry, we're going to get much better tools to learn how to dissect these signals. Because if you think about some of these models have thousands of inputs into them. And with all of those inputs, you're basically trying to do anomaly detection across thousands of streams of data. It's very easy to make false alarms. It's very easy to miss signals. And so it's a science to the monitoring. So it's early days. What the industry is putting out right now is great, and it is helpful, and it's better than we had before. But there's still a lot of work to do. So I think once that hill has been climbed and we're able to plant our flag on the top and say, yeah, look at this model monitoring system we have, it's really cool and it works really well, then yes, I think at that point, other disciplines are going to start to take notice and say, oh yeah, we can borrow components of what data science is doing with keeping a clean house and apply it to our industry as well.
Yeah, and just for our viewers, data modeling is used lots of different ways. There's some obvious data models that have failed badly. Chernobyl is a good one. That was a very primitive data model that failed badly. We've had models that have worked, the tsunami predictions and so forth. The scientific world has been using data models forever. Heck, I was going to try and use a data model to weigh the heck in Curry Atoll. Because data communications was so expensive, we only wanted to fire up the really expensive Iridium data communications link when we knew something was happening. In this case, we're trying to identify the factory ships that are stealing giant clams to make buttons, for God's sakes. Data models are bread and butter for scientists, and I'm absolutely tickled pink that data models are making it into industry, corporate America, because data models are great. You can automate things. You can do a lot of things. And when there are tools to have a feedback loop to tune it and adjust it and make changes, life gets really interesting. And I, for one, applaud you for your efforts, because I used to have to do a lot of this stuff by hand. Heck, I had a desk side Cray just to handle some of the data models I did. And I'm going to spend some time on your website and learn a lot more. And thank you so very much. And you've been a great guest. And, digging through your website, I did notice one very big issue that you get access to external data using something like NFS. Is there any more? How do you secure that? I mean, security for data. Data is the crown jewels. How do you secure something as inherently insecure as NFS?
Yeah. So this goes back to something I mentioned at the beginning, which is one of Domino's core philosophies, which is you have to provide an open approach to data science, or else data scientists won't want to use it. They have to be able to use a variety of tools. And really, Domino makes IT's life just as easy as it does the data scientists, because it lets you govern and provides security for NFS mounts and data transfer, security for roles and permissions. But the way Domino is built is upon Kubernetes. So it has a Kubernetes foundation, Kubernetes first foundation built from the ground up on Kubernetes, with Docker containers being the key player for those software environments that data scientists are going to use and share and manage. And because it's built from the ground up with that Kubernetes first kind of open foundation, you can install it on GKE, EKS. You can install it on Azure. You can install it on-prem, OpenShift, and other forms, other Kubernetes distributions. So that allows you to use pretty much any NFS mount you want, and allows you to use the private virtual environments on the cloud vendors. And so there's a lot of flexibility. Yeah, a lot of flexibility in the way you set this up. You can set it up to customize for your organization's security needs. That's why, really, when you look at our customers, they're some of the most stringent security RFPs out there, and Domino is able to meet them because of our flexibility to work into the way that they require data to be secured, and the way they require their distributed clusters assigned to data science to be configured and managed.
So my flag waving about NFS sounds like a red herring, and I'm glad to hear that. I really am. And this has been a great interview. I'm going to toss it back to Lou because, you know, we're running out of time. I'm so sorry.
That's right. Well, unfortunately, all good things come to an end. Josh, thank you so much for being here. You know, now that we're running a little on time, we want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can go and learn more, maybe even get started with Domino Labs.
Yeah, if you go to dominodatalab.com, you can learn more about what Domino is all about. And on that, you can click on a trial version of Domino that we have running up in the cloud. And you can play around for free for 14 days and give it a spin yourself.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being here. We look forward to having you on again.
All right, great. Thank you, guys.
Take care. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise and tech news podcast in the industry. So tune your podcatcher to Twine. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host. That's right, my co-host, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
I'll tell you, anyone that has moved, there's so many things to get done, so many things to fix, so many boxes to discover. Oh my goodness. But you know what? In between, I'll listen to all your tweets about the show. I'm ADV, NETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. Throw me a tweet. But you're also welcome to throw me an email. I am Chebert, spelled Cheebert, at twit.tv. My students and I had a Dilbert naming theme, so I was obviously Chebert. But you know what? You're also welcome to throw an email to twiet at twit.tv, and that hits all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your ideas. And I am making a list of your suggestions. And as I can find guests that fulfill that, we're going to schedule them as quickly as I can. And, you know, we've had some spectacular shows based on your suggestions, and we'd love to hear from you.
I'm definitely going to be in the sea of boxes starting tomorrow as well, so that should be fun. Well, folks, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and your work?
Well, I'm going to be working on doing webinars. I've got one coming up that I'll ultimately have a link to on the whole issue of converting aware individuals into allies about the here to's, wherefores, whatchamacallits of user awareness training. Also getting ready for a big presentation to take place at Black Hat USA. So that's going to be fun. And in the meantime, just doing research with a lot of great companies. Looking forward to hearing about what the people in the Twiet Riot want to hear about. Best way to tell me, send me a direct message on Twitter. I'm at KG4GWA, and I always look forward to hearing from each and every one of the members of the Twiet Riot.
Thank you, Curtis. Thank you, Chiebert. We couldn't do the show without you. Well, folks, we definitely have to thank you as well. You are the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. That's right. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, as well as the links to the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right. Support your show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice, and listen on any one of your devices, maybe even on any one of your podcatcher applications. We are on all of them, so definitely subscribe. Plus, you may have heard of Club Twit. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. That's right. Amazing feed there. And it's only $7 per month. And one of my favorite things about Club Twit right now is the exclusive access to the members-only Discord channel. Some really fun and interesting conversations and content there. I love it. I love all the people there. So definitely join and be part of the movement. Now, after you subscribe, impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with the gift of Twiat, because we talk about a bunch of tech topics here, especially fun ones. I can definitely guarantee that if you share it with them, they'll find it fun and interesting as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do the show live right now, live.twit.tv. Check it out. Be part of the live stream. Come see how the pizza's made, the behind the scenes, all the fun stuff that we do here on Twit. Of course, if you're going to watch the show live and you want to be part of our notorious chat room as well, we have irc.twit.tv. There are amazing set of characters in there. In fact, we got a bunch of content and questions from there today. So definitely check that out and be part of the live movement as well. Now, definitely right now, hop over to twitter.com/LouMM and, you know, maybe follow me there, because I definitely post a lot of enterprise tidbits there as well. And I get to have great conversations with people like you. And plus, I post a little bit about what I do during my work week at Microsoft. And if you're more interested in that, especially, go to developers.microsoft.com/office and check out all the latest and greatest ways you can customize your office experience to make it more productive, more powerful for your organization. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. We could not do This Week in Enterprise Tech without Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week. We couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support over the years. I also want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. They continue to support us every week, month after month. We couldn't do the show without them. And I also want to thank Mr. Brian Shee one more time, because he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He gets all the show bookings and the plans for the show. So, Chiebert, thank you so much. We couldn't do the show without you, sir. And before we sign out, we also have to thank our editor today, Mr. Victor. He slices and dices and makes us look like pros. So thank you so much, Victor, for all your support, of course. Our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. He's a talented individual, does a lot of amazing things here on Twit. So, Ant, what's coming up for you here on Twit this week?
Mr. Lou, you're so kind, but yeah, had another great show with hands-on photography where I dug into a listener's photograph and gave them a little bit of insight on how to take some better family portraits, because this summertime, everybody's getting together. So let's work on taking some nice, beautiful family portraits.
Love that. I love that. I have to check that out for myself. I have a pretty big family. Thank you, Aunt. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat.
You may have heard about this story, but are you familiar with the story behind the story? Well, every week on Tech News Weekly, my co-host Micah Sargent and I, Jason Howell, speak to the people who are making and breaking the biggest tech news of the week. We're talking with journalists, we're talking with industry veterans, often we're talking with the people who are responsible for the story. Don't miss Tech News Weekly at twit.tv.